April FAC meeting. Happy spring. I'm glad to see everybody. I always enjoy having the face-to-face meetings, even though I love seeing everybody's face on the computer screens. I like seeing them in person, so welcome. A couple of housekeeping details. One is that if you need to use the restroom, they're out in the hallway. There's a little wall right there. They're right behind that wall. So feel free to use them or get up and help yourself to food at any time during the meeting. You don't have to wait for a break or a pause in the conversation. Also, we need to be out of the room at 7:30 this evening, so we're going to move the meeting right along. I don't think we're going to have any trouble being done by 7:30, but just to keep that in mind that we need to be done at 7:30. And thank you, Mallory, for organizing the dinner tonight. It was wonderful and very tasty, and it looks like there's still plenty, so feel free to help yourself if you haven't had any or haven't had enough. All right, I think we're gonna start with the roll call. And tonight's icebreaker, when I call your name, the icebreaker tonight is in honor of Earth Day. And so your icebreaker comment is going to be, what is your favorite zero waste swap? What is your favorite zero
waste swap?
I'll give you mine. Okay. Mine is, I usually never drink out of these. I use a reusable. Even when I travel, I carry this water bottle with me. It's been around the world, so I use a water bottle instead of one of these. Is that a good example?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, let's start with Ashley.
So my name is Ashley, and I'm the public health youth representative. And I think one of my favorite swaps is using like cloth to clean anything. I'm a messy person, so I always have like a cloth in my room just to clean or wipe.
Okay, good.
Alrighty.
Elma.
I'm Elma. I am the non-elected representative for the city of Vancouver. My zero waste swap are glass straws. I love glass straws. Mm-hmm. Much better than the disposable ones. Mm-hmm. And the paper ones.
Or paper
no.
All right, Emily.
I am Emily, the consumer of public health, and a couple others. I make all my own soaps. I like cold process it.
Wow.
Like shampoo bars and body soap and all that.
Wow. Great. We're going to get some good ideas. Franklin. Did I catch you with the mic?
Pardon my mouth. I'm Franklin Johnson. I'm the chair of the Clark County Commission on Aging. In addition to the water bottle and glass straws, or actually we have metal straws, I'm an avid recycler, and I follow the rules.
Good for you. Sometimes it's hard to keep up with the rules.
No greasy pizza boxes.
Chief Mori. Dr. Fisher.
I'm Kevin Fisher. I'm the medical doctor prescribing in Clark County. And I actually used to work as an engineer in consumer products. So zero waste swaps isn't really my jam. But when you think about carbon footprint and how much energy it takes to build a new vehicle, one of the things my family does is we buy used rather than new. Buying a used car is actually less on the carbon footprint than buying a new electric car. Mm-hmm.
All right. Good to know. All right, let's see. Dr. Doppin.
I'm Dr. Kimberly Doppin. I'm a veterinarian practicing in Clark County, and he killed my swap. I bought an electric vehicle. I thought I was doing the right thing, so no gas for me. And actually, I do have a nice coffee mug that I take when I commute into work, and this is the exception. So here we're talking about this, and I feel like I've failed you.
Well, as we're all drinking out of these water bottles.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Mark Collier.
I represent the septic installers, designers, and maintenance people, and I guess near my office, there's an auto repair place, and he's got a big bin for scrap metal and everything. So any scrap that I have, I just throw it into that, and the guy comes about once a week and cleans everything up.
Nice. Great. All right. Marla.
Well, these are just such great ideas, and some of them I've also done. My swap is I have a garden this time of year, every year, and started out as just trying to deal with clay, which was not very fruitful. So my husband has built raised beds for me, which are wonderful, but the sprinkler system sprayed everything, all the walkways and everything, which was not a good idea. So now he's out there redesigning the watering system as we speak, so that I can put the water where the plants are and not where it's not needed.
Nice.
Good job. All right, Michael Watkins.
Here you are.
Hi, I'm Michael Watkins, the tribal manager for the Cowlitz Indian Tribe. And I guess I would say growing up across the river in Oregon, where it seems like everything's recycled, I grew up in a very recycled family that recycled everything, so I've kind of continued that on.
I get frustrated when you can't recycle something you used to.
Yeah, my kids aren't as recyclable as I am, so, and I'm not as much as my mom was. I still try to throw something in the trash, and my mom will pull it out of the trash and put it in the recycle bin.
That's great. Nissa Buchanan.
Hi. Assign the nurse representative. Well, I'm real proud because I brought this guy. I try so hard to use my own grocery bags. It's not 100%. A lot of times they're just sitting in the trunk and I'm halfway through my grocery shopping and remember that I have them. But I try. I try really hard.
I see lots of people who put their groceries back in the basket. And
oh, yeah.
Bags when
I
get
know.
To the car.
It's a lot of unpacking.
Paul.
Oh, your timing is
very good. I know, my timing is great.
I represent the restaurants of Clark County, and we were talking about shopping bags here. I don't use the shopping bags that are at the stores. I have my own that you buy. You know, you buy for a buck or whatever, and I know exactly which Safeway or Fred Meyer, I know which one, and I keep them in my trunk, and I always carry the proper one in. In fact, I always hate to go into Walmart with Winco shopping bags. You know, it's kind of like that. So, that's the way I get all my groceries like that. I don't get anything else. And I'm in constant touch with the recycling people. If I have a question about recycling, I will always call them. I have the information that they send out to you or to your home. But I always, if I have something that, does this go here or does that go there? And I'll call them. I had one call the other day. I called the other day and I said, you know, I've got an 8-ounce glass bottle. But it had olive oil in it, and I've got about 24 of those because I like to take olive oil on a regular basis. And I said, they said, well, be sure to just wash it out. I said, well, you know, olive oil and water have a tough time. You know, so I said, you know, what should I do? He says, well, be sure to not put the cap on. I said, of course not. And he says, and then just put it in with your regular glass. I said, that takes care of it. But I'm in constant contact to make sure that everything is recycled properly.
Good job, Paul. All right, Robert Ferrier.
I'm Rob Ferrier. I'm the Deputy City Manager of Battleground. I'm the non-elected representative of Clark County cities and towns other than Vancouver. I guess my, when you first said, what is it, waste?
Zero waste.
Zero waste. I'm like, I'm a 34 waste.
You got a waste to go to be zero.
Probably my water bottle. I've got one of these and my daughter gives me the little stickers. So this is my office water bottle. It has the Shoot Farm sticker. It's got, if you follow the show, The Office,
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My Bears Beats and Battlestar Galactica sticker. And so, that's what she said sticker.
Good. Let's see, and I already told you I use a water bottle. I also subscribe to another recycle that takes the things that the regular recyclers don't take. So they'll take like the clear containers and bubble wrap and different things like that. So it's kind of nice that all that stuff that I can't put into the regular recycle, I can put in there. So, Scott Johnson.
Scott Johnson, I'm the emergency manager for Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency. I brew and keg my own beer, so I'm not using aluminum or glass.
Yes, we're having the next meeting at his place.
Bring the keg.
Tyler.
Tyler Clary, I represent Clark County Water Utilities, and I wouldn't be doing my profession very good justice if I didn't say I like using bottles, reusable bottles all the time. But I will say something else that I started doing more recently was, you know, a lot of people use the bigger bags at the grocery store to put all their groceries in when they're done. But one thing that I started doing more recently was we bought these little net bags that I also put all my vegetables in, so I'm not using all the plastic bags in the vegetable aisles too. So, and that saves a lot, because if you think about every time you go to the store, pull a plastic bag off for every different vegetable you're getting, and that adds up.
Good job. All right, Councillor Young.
Yes, Councillor Young. I am Councillor Marshall's alternate, and there's, if you're ever on the council and you go through your committee assignments, make sure that you're the alternate for somebody that's responsible and goes to all their meetings. So, it's a great opportunity to be here, because I've often wondered what the discussions were here. But I would say it kind of fits in. So I drive a used electric car.
Oh, so, okay.
Enjoy it. It's a fun ride. If you haven't had an electric car, they're fun.
It is fun.
Yep.
It is, yeah.
If it works for you.
Dr. Melnick.
Both of mine have been done before, but I'll do two. One is I have several cloth bags that I use. I haven't used a paper bag from a grocery. I can't remember when. And one of them, I think, is a Clark County Public. It says Clark. Yeah, one of those Clark County. We have those bags. The other one is in 2014. I got rid of my Chevy. Well, it was the GMC version of the El Camino with the 350 cubic inch gas engine. I've been driving electric cars since 2014.
Joe, Roxanne.
Oh, yes, I'm Roxanne Wolf, I'm the Deputy Director, and I am a big supporter of the Columbian, and we get the newspaper delivered, and I use the newspaper actually when I'm done reading it and doing the crossword to actually put as a weed barrier in my yard, so.
Nice.
Dana. I'm Dana Nguyen, I am the Infectious Disease Director. I do a couple different things. One, I don't use plastic or paper plates or anything. It's always dishware, real dishware, from Osh. And we have a water collection for our yard. We use rainwater to water our very large yard.
Great.
Wow.
That's awesome. Jeff.
Jeff Arbison, Administrative Services Director, Clark County Public Health. I think I've been using grocery bags for way longer than the plastic band, way longer than all that. So I've been using that for years and years and years.
Okay. Mallory?
Oh, I'm so glad you came to me, because I have a really good one.
I would leave you.
I'm Mallory. I'm the executive administrative assistant. My daughter is actually on the green team at school. She's 9 years old. And instead of using the plastic sandwich bags and, you know, quart-size gallon bags, I actually buy, they're called Stasher bags, and they're reusable silicone bags, so she got me into it, but they're really great. You should look into them if you don't know. They do bowls, too, so.
Great. All right, and we have a new member tonight. I'd like to welcome Dr. Trong, who's our dentist,
yay.
And I think I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Melnick to introduce him. And
then
he can tell us what his zero waste.
Are you going to do the zero waste one first, or should I do the introduction first? I'll do the introduction first, and then you can do the zero. So Dr. Trong has a deep, longstanding commitment to public health, and particularly making sure that children in Clark County receive quality dental care regardless of their ability to pay. And I believe you've been involved in the ABCD program as well. So, and the reason this is clearly public health, because dental caries is the most common chronic disease in children, and Dr. Truong is doing everything he can do to help prevent that and working with our team. He's a board certified pediatric dentist and also has worked with the Navajo Nation, I believe, in a small coal mining town in New Mexico where you work?
That's actually about 2 hours away from that coal mining town.
Okay, so you've done both of those. And then for the last 8 years, you've been the owner of Pleasant Valley Pediatric Dentistry. So a lot of experience, and including a commitment to public health. So I think we're waiting for the official announcement from, the council has changed. I think there's some legal issues around appointments and stuff, so we're waiting for the formal appointment, but I think it'll happen pretty soon. So. Anyway, welcome to FAC, and we're really excited to have you as our dentist representative. So I'll let you do zero waste. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My zero waste, I grew up in an Asian household, so this might be kind of weird, or I'm not sure how hygienic this is, but you go to the Thai restaurants, they give you those big plastic tubs for soup. I'll reuse that tub. I'll wash it out with soap water. Now, I know you're not supposed to reuse plastic, plastic bottles after so many times because the bacteria can be lodged into the pores, but I don't know, after a couple times I'll throw it away, but I'll try to reuse it as much as I can until before it gets too gross. So.
Okay. All right, well, welcome, Dr. Truong.
Thank you.
All right, well, thank you. That's interesting. We had a lot of similar things and some new things to try, so thank you. All right, the next item on the agenda is to review our minutes. Did everyone have a chance to read the minutes when they were sent out to you? Mallory has put them up on the screen if you need to look through those.
There are also a couple of copies on the table, too.
Oh, we've got a couple down here, too. All right, if there's no discussion, can I get a motion to approve the minutes, please?
Move approval. Second.
All in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? All right, motion passed. Doesn't look like we have any members of the public today, so we can move on. I'm going to turn the next piece over to Roxanne and to Dana for a little presentation on the strategic plan.
So we wanted to share where we were at in our strategic planning process. So I know that we have shared along the way with that, so the process that we've been going through to develop our strategic plan. We've been working on our 5-year strategic plan since last fall. So it's actually going to turn into probably a 7 or 8 year plan once we get the planning done. But excuse me. So the work really started in late 2022. When we launched the Community Health Assessment, the CHA, and the Community Health Improvement Plan, the CHIP. And we've given some presentations here to this group with regard to that and the feedback that we got from the CHA and the CHIP. And the process that we use to draft our strategic priorities for the strategic plan is that we utilize community feedback that we got through the CHA and the CHIP process. And then also some FAC members were also involved in that process too, so we had some feedback from FAC as well. And then we also had, we implemented a process that was a cross-departmental and cross-functional team within our department, a structure where we had focus groups and we had surveys. So we were able to get feedback from across our department as well to help us draft our strategic priority areas. And so we used that along with the feedback from the community, feedback that we got from FAC, in order to draft, to start drafting our strategic plan. And using that feedback, what we also wanted to do is make sure that we were aligning with the Board of Health resolution declaring racism as a public health crisis. And we also aligned it with our foundational public health services, which really are the baseline capabilities that every public health department needs to have. So we wanted to make sure that our priorities were also aligned with those two things as well. So we used all this information, and
what we were able to do is come up with four strategic priority areas, and we're in the process of finalizing the plan now. We're really close, and we're going to be meeting shortly, in probably the next week or so, with our department. We've given a brief presentation to the Board of Health already, and we're going to be meeting with our department shortly as well. But we ended up with four strategic priority areas. The first strategic priority area is community connection. And what this is really focused on is improving the coordination and joint decision-making with our community. So we're going to have opportunities. One of the things that we heard is that we need to be more engaging with our community. We need to have the community more at the table when we're making decisions related to the services that we provide. And so this strategic priority area is really going to be focused on that. The second area is workforce capacity development. And this is actually foundational to all of our priority areas. So as we are developing our workforce and the capacity that we have with our workforce, it's really going to underlie all the work that we do across the board. So this is really foundational to all of these priority areas. And this is also recognized or identified by the state as a foundational capability that every public health department needs to have, is be working on our capacity and our workforce development in our agency. And the idea around this is that we're really improving the knowledge and skill sets of our current workforce, but also increasing the diversity in our workforce. We want to make sure that we're representing, you know, the community that we represent is represented in our department. So that's really what the strategic priority area is going to be focused on. And then the third area, this is also foundational to all the work that we're doing, is racial health, racial and health equity. And this is really focused on using evidence-based approaches in working to eliminate health disparities in our community. And as with the workforce development, this is really foundational to all our work too. This is not just, you know, an addition to how, it's not just additional to our work, it's how we do our work. So it's foundational to our work. So we're really going to be focused on looking at processes and procedures and how we're working with the community. And this is also in alignment with the resolution, the Board of Health resolution. And then the fourth area that we had based on the feedback we received was the leadership and administrative competencies. And this is really focused on increasing our operational efficiency by developing and using a very robust performance management system. And so we've had some performance management in our department, but we've really never developed it out the way that we needed to really track our progress. And that's what this is about, is we're developing this process. We're going to be working on not only the work plans with the managers, and I'll talk about that in a second, but we're going to be developing the metrics that we are going to be tracking and reporting out on. So we will be reporting those out to not only the Board of Health, but to FAC on an ongoing basis as we get those metrics placed. So we will be adding that to our agendas coming in the near future. What we're doing to implement our plan. So we're finalizing the plan as we speak now. I mentioned that we're going to be sharing it with our department in the next week or so. And then we're going to be publishing it out to the public. So it'll be on our website as well, and we'll be sharing it with community partners. And we're beginning, in order to implement the plan, we're working with our management team and some subject matter experts in our organization, in our department, to actually develop work plans that are in alignment with those strategic plan priority areas. There's already work that's being done that we've already started, that we've been doing for a while, that already aligns with our strategic plan. But what we need to do is not only identify that work, but develop the metrics that we're going to track. There's also some new work that we're going to be doing with starting in 2024. But really foundational to this work is that performance management plan that I was talking about. It's really going to be critical to really track our progress, and also track where maybe we need to pivot, maybe make some changes. Speaking of changes, the change management committee, which we're also developing right now too, is going to be foundational to this work, and will help with not only keeping us on track. A lot of times strategic plans, and I think you've been in organizations where this happens, you develop a strategic plan and it's really pretty, it's a lovely document, and it goes somewhere on a shelf never to be seen again until you redo it, right? So we really wanted to make sure that we were holding ourselves accountable for actually doing the work, measuring, tracking our progress, and pivoting when we need to, and when we see that there's barriers, or when we see that we're not necessarily meeting the objectives that we had, doing a little bit more of a deep dive to find out why, and what we need to do to make sure that we can pivot and continually improve. So we're really excited about this progress, this process. It's a very robust. We have teams set up to make sure that this is moving forward. The whole leadership team is making sure that this is going to be part of our performance evaluations as well across our department. So we're really excited about this process. This is a very robust process. We haven't really engaged in a process like this before that's this robust, and so we're very excited about moving forward. So that's it in a nutshell, and we will be bringing back some additional information on it. Any questions?
You said this is the first time that you've engaged in a strategic plan?
This is the first time we've engaged in a robust process like this with the community involvement and that process that I described. We have had strategic plans in the past, but you know, they tend to not be
more internal.
What's that?
It was more internal.
Yes, more internal, correct. Yep.
Thank you.
Kind of more of the shelf-like.
Yes, the shelf-like. It was the shelf-like.
I'm really excited about this one.
Yeah.
So, and we have a process in place with the work teams to push us along on this.
Yeah.
What I think I heard, and I really like this idea, is that there's going to be some measurement, metrics that you can use to assess your progress toward your desired outcomes. So,
well, the great part of this too is that, you know, developing metrics is a skill, and it's hard, you know, and figuring out your objectives and your goals, you know, and all that stuff. So it's a skill. So in addition to, you know, us actually building this, this is part of our workforce development plan too. It's building that capacity to understand how to build metrics that really are reflective of the work that we're doing. So how to build a good change management plan, you know, those sorts of things. So it's really cross-cutting, so that's exciting too.
I imagine this is the kind of thing you can use to inform your budgeting practice going forward.
Totally. Right,
so as you're presenting things to policymakers, you can say, we're recommending this funding allocation because blah, blah, blah.
And this is how it aligns with our strategic priority areas.
Yeah, thank you.
100%. Any questions? Well, thank you all.
Good work.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, now I'd like to introduce Dana, and she is going to give us a little presentation on STI HIV.
So full disclosure, I'm not Rachel. Rachel reports to me. She's our STI HIV program manager. I'm also a nurse, though. I'm a nurse, certified in infection prevention, and I'm the director of infectious disease, and was the previous manager of this program, so I'm really excited to be able to talk about it. Okay, here we go. And it's not my slides, so hopefully I can do it justice. I'm going to do my best. There we go. All right. So just a couple goals and objectives that we want to achieve tonight. We want to discuss the purpose and importance of STI and HIV surveillance activities. I'm going to go over some surveillance data and trends. We want to have a shared understanding of the comprehensive STI and HIV prevention services that are provided by Clark County Public Health. And we really want to highlight our community partnerships. Also, April is STI Awareness Month.
I did not know that.
The more you know. All right. So sexually transmitted infections are the most commonly reported diseases in the state of Washington. And so before we delve into the data, I'd like to first discuss the purpose and importance of STI HIV prevention and the surveillance activities that our team works on. Most individuals with STIs do not have symptoms. They frequently don't know they have an STI. So when they present when they don't seek treatment because they don't really have a problem, it gets, you know, they transmit their STI to their friends, unfortunately. And what happens then is that these people can develop really serious complications. Our focus of our program is to really incorporate prevention activities and data surveillance so that we can work towards the prevention of transmission of STIs within Clark County. Public health surveillance includes reporting, investigation, collection, and distribution of data about illness and death. We can visualize the number of reported cases and associated trends, and STI-HIV surveillance data directs the implementation of our programmatic efforts and where we need to place our energy and efforts towards prevention. And where our focus might need to be. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that here in a second. Any questions before I go on? All right, so what you see before you here is, you know, STIs, so gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, HIV, they are reportable conditions. And in order for us to generate surveillance data and to know what's happening within our community, we need that information to be reported to us from our healthcare partners and laboratories. So the first step of us finding out what's going on and having a sense of what's happening in our community starts with the notifiable condition reporting, which is really important, and it's a key piece of the work that we do. Any questions about that? I'm going to talk a little bit about surveillance. So this is the Clark County trends that you're seeing here from 2023. I do want to call out, though, if you go to our website or if you go out to the Washington State Department of Health website, the data that they have displayed is 2022 data because there's a lag in data reporting. So for chlamydia, you can see that we have 1,786 cases. That was a 10.1% decrease since 2018. For gonorrhea, we had 506 cases. That was a 22% decrease since 2018. Syphilis, 234 cases, is 175.3% increase since 2018. That is also a national trend. We're seeing nationally the cases of syphilis rising significantly, and also what we call congenital syphilis. So the mom gets pregnant, she has the baby, she's got a baby, she gets syphilis. That is a 500% increase for Clark County. Our trends over the course of years are, this should be a never event, it's usually zero. We had 5 cases in 2023. And we're on target to surpass that this year. Wow. Questions about that?
Why is there a big swing between chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis in reported cases?
That's a great question. It's, I don't know the answer to that. It's about practices, I'm sure.
I'm going to speculate here, but a lot of chlamydia is asymptomatic. And it's a matter of being seen and being tested. People were, during the height of the pandemic, may have been getting less evaluation, less, yeah, so.
So it's a good point. During the COVID pandemic, what we do know is, and it wasn't just Clark County, it's nationally, a lot of testing and treatment just didn't happen because people weren't going anywhere. It doesn't mean that there wasn't disease transmission or that there wasn't STIs. It just wasn't in the forefront of what was happening. Everybody's focus was really razor sharp on COVID.
Thank you.
It's a great question. Okay, so talk a little bit about HIV. So the HIV rates in Clark County, you can see here, so the black line is Washington State and the blue line is Clark County. So we're trending down, which is a good thing. We want to see that happen. You can see over on the, your right. You know, we had a little bit of a jump up in 2019 and 2021, but we're on our way back down. In 2022, I will say that I think some of that was just lack of reporting and testing because of the pandemic. Okay, so prevention services, this is what I really want to highlight, is our prevention team and what we do. They're an awesome team, they do a great job, and we have some partners in the room we partner with, Kobe River Mental Health. So, you know, most important thing we can do is prevent the spread or prevent transmission. That is the most important thing that we can do. We do that through a number of ways. We do, most importantly, case investigation and disease intervention. Testing and treatment. Our team provides testing and treatment at our harm reduction center and through telehealth. And then we like to make sure that we provide really appropriate and ready resources, referrals, and health education to all the individuals that we come in contact with. So our prevention activities support our community providers in the following ways. So we have the ability to provide Bicillin to our community providers that are seeing individuals that are not insured or don't have, maybe they're underinsured. They have insurance, but they can't afford to take them to pay for the medication, the Bicillin that they need for their syphilis treatment.
Question.
Sure.
In veterinary medicine, we only use generic names. Is that a brand name for some type of penicillin? Okay, got it. Thank you.
That's a great question.
Thank you.
Education to our providers and our community partners on treatment and reporting guidelines. As I mentioned at the beginning, notifiable condition reporting, it is our bread and butter. It's the most important thing that we have so that we can have a sense of what's happening out in our community. Without that, we don't know what's happening. And then the most important thing we can do is connect our patients to providers for care and treatment. our program also provides testing for gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, HIV, and hepatitis C. We also provide treatment for gonorrhea and chlamydia to individuals, but also to their partners through EPT, expedited partner therapy. And we link individuals to care for syphilis, super important. We also, as I mentioned, provide telehealth, and we can provide individuals with self-testing kits for gonorrhea and chlamydia so that they can do their own collection, and we send it off to the state. And then if it comes back positive, we can treat them. And robust health education and prevention services, you know, teaching people about safer sex, making sure that you're doing all the right things, good things, so that you don't spread your good stuff.
Question?
Sure.
It says you treat for gonorrhea and chlamydia and you link to care for syphilis. Why is that linked?
That's a great question. Would you like to touch that?
Well,
I mean, I can, but...
No, go ahead.
So, you know, syphilis is something that requires a comprehensive medical evaluation. We don't have a clinic. We're not a clinic. We don't have that medical provider or the allied clinician that can actually see the individual, do a robust physical assessment, and follow them.
Got it. It's just more logistics involved.
Yeah.
Okay,
absolutely.
Thank you.
So the, go ahead.
I know you mentioned the Harm Reduction Center. How are you? How do most people contact you and get help? Is it through harm reduction, or do you reach out to people that were...
That's a great question. So because these are notifiable conditions, that's like our first way of finding out whether somebody has...
So you contact the people that...
We get the lab result first, and then we will, we'll reach out to them. And it's sometimes challenging. Some people don't like to talk to us, but our staff is trained on interview techniques and how to do it in a way that people feel safe and they're not feeling like, you know, it's an imposition or scary. The Harm Reduction Center is such a small piece of what we do. That same location, though, we do provide testing and treatment on different days of the week, separate from that component of the work.
By the way, speaking of syphilis, I can't remember the last time I haven't seen the patient myself, but we have a case of neurosyphilis. So
we do have several cases of that. It's in a Greek.
Yeah, so... syphilis can
it can advance into the neurological system,
so,
and it's we'd like to prevent that.
How does it work with like babies who are born in Oregon? Because like especially a lot of more complicated ones are like Kaiser would be like how is reporting work for like residency or
it works for residency and Kaiser actually they report both states because they have. Very large footprint here,
like OHSU too.
It's based on residency.
It's based on residency.
If they, even if they get treated in Oregon, if they're a Washington State resident, they still have to notify us.
Okay.
And part of the reason for that is, they have contacts here as well. So, if somebody has a sexually transmitted, infection, they may get treated at OHSU. But we do. It's the same drill we do for when you think about it. We do for COVID-19, we do case investigation and identify contacts. And those contacts are here, if they're residents here. So we need to be aware of that.
That's a great question.
Yeah, sorry for the long-winded answer.
I think it's great. Any other questions?
So is there data that correlates the kind of the demographics of who gets these STIs, and I'm just wondering if the linking care, so you're saying that care is not covered by public health, right? It's a private...
We're not a clinic, so we don't provide the full, robust, comprehensive, like we don't do the evaluation, we don't have a physician or an allied clinician that can do the physical exam.
So basically, you have to, out of pocket if you're uninsured for the syphilis care, then, is what you're saying.
Well, we partner with CMAR.
We link people to care that
they can afford. But if they're uninsured or underinsured, that the bicillin, mm-hmm. we can provide the provider, like let's say it's CMAR, mm-hmm. with that bicillin for that individual, so they don't have to not get treated because they can't afford it.
And that's injectable. So
it's a great question. Did I answer it?
Yes.
This is our last slide. I want to call out on the presentation for tomorrow with the Board of Health. CAP is missing off of here. It was not intentional. I think that
Cascade
AIDS Project is, they're one of our really heavy partner, and they're not on here, but they are a big partner. I want to call that out. But these are our main partners for our STI HIV program. We work with the Oregon AIDS Education and Training Center. In fact, our team just did a presentation last month to here in Vancouver to a lot of providers related to syphilis education. So that's one of our wonderful partners, the Free Clinic of Southwest Washington. We're actually offering testing and treatment through that location with them. It's been a really great partnership. CMR they do a great job with not just our STI HIV program, but also our TB program. They're wonderful. And then Clinton River Mental Health, we work really hard with our commissioner. And we're just really lucky to have great partnerships. So any other questions that I can try to answer?
Most of these diagnoses start with a lab test.
Correct.
So do you want to report both from the lab and the medical provider?
The law requires both.
The law requires both.
Hospitals, clinicians, and labs are all required to report. Do we get reports from all of them? No.
Not always.
But if you look at the WACS, the Washington Administrative Code, it requires them all to report. We do hear from, probably more from the labs because it's more electronic.
Yeah, the electronic reporting system.
The problem with the labs is that they only report a positive lab. If somebody is a suspect, for example, you should be reporting that too, but you know, anyway.
And the different conditions have different reporting timelines.
Yep.
As well, so depending on the severity. Any other questions?
I'm a little behind, so you have to catch me up. Some years ago, it was referred to as STD, and now I see STI.
STIs, yes.
Can you explain when that changed and why?
Well, the official change, I think, has been slow on the uptake. It's been in transition since, I want to say, and you can correct me if I'm wrong for a moment, I want to say about 2012.
It may be that long.
But we didn't really appreciate the actual transition formally until right before COVID, actually. The reason for the change is because they are infections.
The other thing I point is with a disease, it connotes symptoms and illness, whereas a lot of STIs are asymptomatic. That's part of the problem with chlamydia. It can be asymptomatic. So I think the concept of a sexually transmitted infection versus disease, and you know, you can prevent it while, you know, somebody's got chlamydia and they're asymptomatic, you can certainly prevent it. You can cure them and prevent them from transmitting it to other folks. Similarly, syphilis. You know, you got primary and secondary syphilis, but then you can go on to be asymptomatic and for years and still
transmitted.
Yeah, still. Sure. So STI is probably a little bit more accurate.
It's a great question.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question.
Anything else?
Do you guys only provide like health education after someone is diagnosed, or do you guys provide it as what's preventable?
That's an awesome question. We provide it in both ways, preemptive and reactive, I'll call
it.
So
how does that work like within our community?
So we have partnerships with Clark College. We go out and talk to the colleges. We go to the high schools. We have nurses that go and talk at the high schools.
How do they talk to them? Do they talk to them like this, or do they talk to them?
No.
I feel like this is more like having the data out there is more helpful because high school kids are smart enough to understand.
There, but it's tailored to, we try to tailor it to the age group and so we can meet our audience where they're at.
Yeah, I do feel like knowing what trends are will help people understand, you know, the depth of
the significance
transition.
Of how important
this
is,
absolutely. So tell your nurses to show
them. The other thing that we're not doing here that might, I don't know what you do with kids, is to talk about the diseases, the associated diseases. You know, what are the complications of chlamydia? You know, pelvic inflammatory disease, and what does that mean? Same thing with, you know, gonorrhea, syphilis, talking. We haven't given a clinical piece here because we're talking more about the epidemiology, but I assume you do some of that.
We do. We talk about the, you know, the implications of having the illness and not having it treated, and what can happen down the road.
I think you mentioned demographics. Imagine most of your nomenclature is victims of these diseases are trend younger.
Did they trend younger? That's what I was trying to get at.
They do not.
Depends on the disease.
Depends on the disease. Okay.
That's interesting. I would figure young people being young people, they're going to do what they're going to do.
You will be surprised.
No, there's like, there is
really?
I would like skilled nursing facility outbreaks.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's not uncommon
all right.
in our.
Okay.
Chlamydia is generally a younger population, but it varies depending on
it does vary. It depends. Also varies depending on where you live in the United States. So that's another.
And again, syphilis is a chronic condition as well if you're not recognized and treated. You might remember the Tuskegee study, which is one of the horrible things where it went on until, I think, 72. Black men with syphilis, even though treatment was available, the study withheld treatment intentionally so they could see what the long-term complications of syphilis was. It's one of the horrible examples of racism in both public health and healthcare in the United States.
I'll just point out, several years ago, I lived in Vegas for many years, and they had multiple outbreaks of gonorrhea in the retirement communities there.
I mean, it's more common in younger groups than in skilled nursing facilities.
But you don't want to just target that age group as the,
Poor people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's stupid.
Whether you're 16 or 76,
you only play so much bingo.
I think the most important thing is really making sure that the prevention components and getting people connected to care are really focused on, and that's what our team works really hard on.
Kevin,
you talked about going into high schools. Do you have any kind of effort to go into senior living facilities?
You know, that's a really great point, that we have not. Maybe we probably need to refocus our attention on that. It's off topic here, but what we do focus on the senior living facilities is multi-drug resistant organisms. So a little different, but because those people have, they have lines, they have drains, they have things. I mean, I don't know, but we should maybe rethink that. It's a good point.
I don't know if you have the resources or the funding for things like free condom giveaways.
Oh, we have condoms? Yes.
Condoms
galore.
Great.
Okay.
Just get
a wall of condoms. Yes, they're readily accessible. I think part of the challenge we're seeing, though, with condom use, it's declined over the last several years because of the onset of treatment, PrEP. Mm-hmm. So a lot of individuals are like, I don't need to use a condom anymore. Oh, I'll just take a pill. Which is problematic. Now we're seeing the end result of that, because it's like, no, that was a bad idea.
And that might be contributing to syphilis
as well.
It could
be. But syphilis rates are actually up in the heterosexual population. So. Any other questions?
It's not an STI, but you had mentioned hepatitis at the beginning. Is that trending up as well?
Hepatitis C is trending up in the, what do we call it, the boomers? Is the age group still? Dr. Fisher, you might be able to answer this better.
I think Hep C might actually be trending down
now,
because most opioid use is not injected any longer.
Yeah, that's true.
Most of the IV drug use right now is just methamphetamine, and so it's the bleak silver lining of the fentanyl epidemic.
And the new veterinary.
And Hep C is more primarily transmitted through blood contact, not so much. If at all, as sexually transmitted. Hep B is more potentially sexually transmitted. I was listening to, I was on a statewide webinar. They'd done a survey of people coming to harm reduction centers, and I think we participated in that survey. But methamphetamine use, I mean, you've probably been saying this, methamphetamine is up. We're seeing we're beginning to see more methamphetamine. I've also heard that fentanyl use, I heard this on PBS, fentanyl is so cheap now, the cartels can't make as much money out of it, so heroin may be making a comeback because you don't make as much money on fentanyl. I don't know whether you've heard that or not.
Yeah, well, if you think about the trend in human history, the drugs are getting more potent, so it would be kind of backwards for heroin to become in vogue again.
But I mean, fennel is so cheaply made, and if you're trying to make money out of selling it,
it's also so potent that you can transport a smaller amount, as opposed to needing this much of something
it's
else. Right?
It's 100 times the potency of morphine and 50 times that of heroin.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Easier to transport.
Yeah. You also briefly touched on tuberculosis. That used to be one of the big items that was followed back many years ago when I did public health. Is that still on the radar screen, or has that been pretty much?
It's not only the radar screen. We're seeing more of it. I don't have the exact number. I know experientially we're seeing more of it. Tuberculosis is endemic in the world, and it's one of the major causes of death worldwide. And as there's more unrest in the world and there's more people moving around, you have you're more likely to see it, you know, through travel and immigration and all that. We're seeing the lights are going on. We're seeing tuberculosis is here and with us. We spend a lot of our time on TV,
Tuberculosis is very, very prevalent in Africa.
It's prevalent in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Including, part of the problems with parts of the world, as you see more drug-resistant TB, because if TB, the problem with TB is you certainly want to treat it, but you don't want to under-treat it, because if you under-treat it, you encourage the growth of resistant organisms. And that happens in various places around the world where some of the antibiotics are more, they're available, not restricted.
They're
as
used much more frequently and less appropriate.
So our way of dealing with tuberculosis is here is making sure we treat it appropriately, and we do something called directly observed therapy, where we watch people taking the medication to ensure they get the right drugs at the right time and complete treatment, which can be 6 months or more. I could spend hours talking about it. You don't want to hear me doing that. But, we're seeing a significant amount of TB.
I'm not sure where we are on time. I just want to make sure I'm being mindful. Are we good? Other questions before I sit down? All right. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
All right. Our next agenda item is around community updates, and this is something we usually do at the end of the meeting, and this is sort of the end and the beginning, or the middle of the meeting. But community updates is if you have anything from your organization or group that you represent, if you have something you want to share with the group, this would be a time to do that. And I can start with one. I'm also a member of the Food System Council that looks at food access around our community. And every 2 months, they put on an event called Eat, Drink, and Be Local at the Heathen Brewing Company downtown from 5:30 to 7:30. And we always focus on something around food. And this month's topic is herbs. So we invite local farmers to come, and they'll talk about them growing herbs, how you can grow herbs, how you would use herbs. And they always will have a taste testing as well. So the next one is on May 8th. It's always the second Wednesday of the month. So May 8th is the next one at Haven, and anybody is welcome to go and attend. We've had some where we tasted breads from around the world, breads and spreads from around the world, and that was really interesting. Last month's was microgreens. So, but the one on May 8th is herbs. So I invite anybody that wants to come.
Thank you.
All right. Does anybody have, let's see, Dr. Milner, did you want to talk about our meeting that we're going to have with the Commission on Aging?
Yes, and Franklin can add to this, but having Franklin on FAC is great, because he's the chair of the Commission on Aging, and we work really, and the Commission on Aging is kind of like FAC in a way, is it's they work with the Clark County Planning Department, and kind of like FAC works with Clark County Public Health. And we're already doing some collaboration with the planning department around the comprehensive plan. There's a climate requirement now with this new statute that passed that it has to take that into consideration. But Franklin approached me and And I'm grateful to that. I've talked about, you know, what might be the opportunities for a collaboration between Public Health Advisory Council and the Commission on Aging, along with our two departments. And Dr. Oriaco, who's he's the director of the planning department, is very interested in having this conversation. So we're going to have a meeting, and we'll get back to FAC on this, but we're going to have a meeting on May 14th. Sandy is going to be there as FAC chair. Franklin will be there as Commission on Aging chair, and Dr. Oriaco and I will be there, and I think some of our staff will be there as well. Just exploratory discussion that we'll bring back. We'll bring back to FAC, and you'll bring back, I'm sure, the commission on that. I'm sorry if I'm talking too much. Add anything. I'm kind of excited about the opportunities. I know we work really closely. FAC worked really closely with the planning department around the Growing Healthier report. You might remember, some of you have been long timers might remember that. So there's all kinds of opportunities. And we were just talking about demographics here and the conversation about sexually transmitted infections. So there's probably all kinds of opportunities here that we'll bring back.
And if I may just add briefly, this is our aging readiness plan. I don't expect you all to have one, because I know you don't. But anyway, the first aging readiness plan was developed in 2012. And in 2022, we thought, okay, this is 10 years old, we're just coming out of the pandemic. And so we felt that it needed an update. So we were able to, with the generous support of the Carr County Commission, we were able to hire a contractor to help us update this, and most significantly, we added a sixth chapter or a new chapter on emergency preparedness, because during the pandemic we learned that so many of the services that are provided to our seniors were interrupted or not being able to be delivered in the traditional way. So we held a series of fireside chats, and that led to some of the input that we used to update this plan. We also put quite an effort into engaging the community. We sent out a very extensive survey, printed in four different languages. We compiled the results of that survey. And so as a result of that and the public input, we came up with some, don't hold me to this, but I think it's 87 strategies that the public suggested that we engage in. So we're in the process now of kind of like verifying those to say, okay, is this feasible to implement? Has it already been implemented someplace or in a different format or whatever? So one of the most significant things we did in emergency preparedness, that's our theme for this year, and we have partnered with CRESA, and we're having a series of presentations each month on how to prepare your to-go bag. Like when something happens, you know, you want to have it there so you can just pick up one thing and head out the door. Also, we're talking about how to prepare your home supplies for if there's a stay-in-place kind of emergency. And so it's been very educational and enlightening to have this collaboration. And we've noticed that as we've gone through these different presentations, throughout the year, it's going to go from zero to, you know, how you develop your go bag, how you get your house together, and how you have a plan, like in case something happens and, you know, one member of the family is on the other side of the river or something like that, you know. So it's been very educational, and I think it's actually increased engagement and enthusiasm. One other quick point, we just had interviews for new members, and we had four different applicants with nursing experience who applied. So it was both exciting and frustrating because we couldn't have all of them on there. So we're trying to explore and brainstorm some ways in which people who are interested and want to volunteer, if there's some way that we can use that energy outside of just being commission members. So we're in the process of exploring that. And since Mr. Young is here, I just want to say they have been a tremendous supporter in the commission. They provide staff to help us out, and sometimes even big bucks. So for that, we're very appreciative. So thank you again for that.
Thank you.
any questions.
Just to be clear, it's the articulate and knowledgeable part of Crescent that's working with him. It's not me.
Great. Anybody else have something?
Yes. A couple meetings ago, I can't remember how many, I had talked about onslaught of Giardia happening, mm-hmm. right? And that's mm-hmm. a zoonotic mm-hmm. disease. Well, now we're seeing hookworms. Oh, I know. So hookworms are another type of, it's a type of worm actually. Giardia is not an organism, but hookworms are very zoonotic and they can cause serious illness in people. They're typically, they're passed in the poop of dogs and people. And people typically get it by walking barefoot in the dog parks or in your yard. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make people aware of that. So we're seeing a whole lot of cases. I can't remember the last time I saw a hookworm case before this year. Years. And now my colleagues and I have seen dozens every week at every clinic. So it's easily treated.
What kind of
symptoms
would it
cause?
Would it be just GI symptoms in a
GI in the people? Human? I'm not trained in human medicine, but I believe it's vomiting, diarrhea, bloody stool.
GI symptoms, but GI again, symptoms I'd have to look it up right now because I haven't.
Which is also the symptoms in dogs too. Yeah. So.
I just want to add on to your comment.
Yeah.
It's very important to do that even in your home. We happen to have a wrought iron fence, and I didn't realize it, but animals come through the bars and leave little gifts. So even in your own yard, where you think you know what's going on, be careful.
Yeah, and hookworms are not just dogs and not just people. They're not species specific, although cats seem to be relatively immune to them. They're just not small dogs, they're just different. But other small mammals can transmit it as well, so that's a good point.
I just have one other announcement that was passed to us that Clark County Planning is working on writing a chapter for the comprehensive plan on climate change, and they're going to be working on that over the next year. And they are, and I will be sure to put this in the minutes as to who to contact. But they're making themselves available to speak to groups about climate change and the process that they're going through to write this chapter in the comp plan and trying to get community input. And there's also a survey that's being put out here now, and it'll be due May 12th, so that you can do online to start giving your input into that process that they're doing to create that chapter for the comp plan. So I have the news release here if anyone wants to read it. I don't want to read the whole lengthy thing, but I'll make sure in the minutes to put who to contact if you'd like to have someone come to speak to a group that you have about the climate change and the comp plan, or if you want to complete the survey. Yes.
Hopefully this is appropriate, but I continue growing more and more concerned about the fentanyl crisis that we're experiencing, and now Trank is now come into our community. I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but it's this work is incredibly important, working on STI and things, but I don't know that people are necessarily dying from it, and they're dying at an alarming rate now. I mean, it is like doubling every year the amount of people that are dying for fentanyl.
You're talking about xylazine?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know the slang for it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so my question, there was a couple things that I was hoping that, this could be a subject that could be worked on and maybe like a work session as well to see what public health is, what their role is, what they're doing, ideas for how we can expand or adapt. I think some of that's adaptation. I also am curious, though, in terms of trying to understand the dynamics of the individuals that are overdosing and dying, and Dr. Melnick, you may know the answer to this, or you may not, but one of the things that I would love to see if we can start tracking would be overdose deaths and cross-referencing to the HMIS system to see the correlation, just to understand the population a little bit better of who is overdosing. But I mean, it is such a huge problem, and we're like, there's lag time with all of this, and so we're just at the beginning. It's just going to get worse and worse every year. The numbers are going to get worse.
So we have opioid data and overdose data on our website. One of the things we'll be having with the Board of Health, and we'll probably do this with FAC if you're interested, is take you to that data. The state is also developing a much more robust opioid, what's the word I'm looking for? A dashboard.
Surveillance.
A dashboard. So, and their work, I've been participating in a work group looking at that. So that's working as well. But we certainly can get you opioid data, including overdose data, including the demographics.
Okay, so there is a way to cross-reference that?
Yep.
That would be great, because, you know, we hear, generally speaking, in the newspaper and stuff like that about homeless individuals that are overdosing and dying, but you don't quite hear about the people that are at home living the normal lives that are dying from it.
So I believe the state data is going to have housing status, but I'm not sure the stuff. Do we have it on our website? Right?
I have to look again. I know it is a data point that's collected.
And
I'm
not
sure if it's reported.
Like they're not reporting deaths. Like, so that.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And I'm aware that the HMIS does not capture it. It says deceased, I think, from my understanding, but it doesn't say how
and
or anything.
Almost none of them do. One case manager has to put it in, and there's like standards for doing that.
I'm trying to remember whether Wales, the death reporting system, has housing status at time. It has location.
It has it, but I don't know if there's.
It has location at time. I don't know that we're. The other thing that we're working on is getting, being able, and we'll be talking to the council about this at some point, is a Randox machine so that we can get toxicology with the decedents through our medical examiner program. So you can get, instead of waiting for weeks to get drug toxicity results, you can get it immediately.
I will be very supportive of that. I promise you that.
That's a preview. You will be hearing from us about that. So it's called a Randox machine. And I'm pretty sure the death reporting has location, and I think, having filled out these things, I have to look, so I don't know.
At least by zip code it's available. We know which zip code.
It is available by zip code.
So we'll get as much information as we can.
This is kind of an all hands on deck situation. It's a real crisis. So sorry, that's just my soapbox here. But
I want to follow that. Being a veterinarian, I am flummoxed at xylazine being used this way. It's an old school drug. I no longer use it. None of my colleagues use it in small animal, but still used in large animal. I think one of the problems is that it's not a controlled substance. You can just buy it.
I was flummoxed when ivermectin was being
used
for COVID-19.
And there is a reversal agent for it, but it's, you know how long it took for Narcan to get where it is already. Mm-hmm. It's not everywhere it needs to be. It'd be light years before you get the reversal agent for this drug. But it's not a controlled substance, so it's way easier to get. You can just have an account somewhere at a clinic and buy it. And it just comes in a little box. Yeah.
You know, I know that there was a Columbian article about it, and certainly being unhoused is a risk factor because anybody becomes unhoused. Mm-hmm. Just the challenge of living on the street, living in that conditions, just to get by, people will use. I think, you know, the answer to, you know, we certainly need to deal with the opioid crisis and all that, but we also need to think about solution for the housing problem to begin with. So, I think that the general thought is people start using and then they become houseless, but I think the reverse works a lot. People become houseless for a variety of reasons, and then they start using because it's a way to get by.
And the other thing with xylazine is people who use it inappropriately, I guess any human using it is inappropriate, it's a veterinarian, but they get drug sick really much faster and more serious than fentanyl or heroin.
By the way, I believe at our harm reduction center, we're not only giving out fentanyl test strips, but we're, aren't we, don't we have xylazine test strips as well? Or we don't?
No.
We do not? Okay. For some reason, I thought we might.
So the
you guys
once
those?
They start with xylazine, it just it's a domino effect way faster.
I thought we had
some. Mm-hmm. Stronger than fentanyl or heroin.
I think, yeah, we'll get more information about it. I know we have fentanyl test strips, but I think you can get xylazine test strips.
And that
as well.
Was in the survey for the harm reduction services across
good.
The state.
Okay.
That was one of the things that people
yeah.
requested was
yeah.
more testing supplies to test their.
The problem with the harm reduction center is it's a great place to see people who are at risk for substance use disorder. The problem is, as more people go to fentanyl with smoking, you are seeing the reason for a lot of people coming in was to exchange syringes, but we're not seeing as much of that anymore because people are smoking. So that was a way to basically get some entree to that population. So it's pretty difficult.
I just have a question. Are you familiar with Portland Street Medicine?
Yeah.
The group. Is there anything comparable to that in Clark County?
Yeah, Columbia River operates a mobile team. Includes a nurse and a physician assistant.
Okay. Does Lifeline have one as well? Or
they don't.
They do not. Okay.
So just to give you a scope, is one out of every 700 Clark County residents is in treatment for opioid addiction at my clinic. So that's just one clinic.
The great thing that they're doing is increasing access to medication for opiate use disorder, and that is underused. We need to get more of that out there. We're a champion for it, so.
All right, great conversations. So I don't want to cut it off, but we do need to move on to our committee meetings. So we're going to move into our work sessions with our committee meetings. And we've talked about some of the committees that we have. We have an active budget committee, a bylaws committee, and membership committee. And at this time, we're going to merge the bylaws and membership committee, mainly because we're the same members, and their duties overlap a bit too, because what membership wants to do, it needs to change the bylaws. So those are some standing committees. And I've talked about, you know, having some interest from some of you to join some of these committees. Well, we're creating a couple of new, more short-term committees. And so tonight will be an opportunity for you to kind of decide if you want to sit in and see what bylaws is all about or what budget is all about or these two new committees to help kind of move us forward in the work that we do here. So we do have, Jeff is going to lead the budget committee tonight, and the anticipated members are Elma, Tyler, and Dr. Fisher at this point. And so he will be leading the budget committee. The bylaws and membership committee is going to be facilitated by Marla and myself. And the other members are Peggy, who's not here. So it might just be Marla and myself. But we welcome any new members to that committee for sure. And bylaws right now is working on the consensus model and switching over to a consensus method of making decisions. So that's going to be our topic for tonight. Now the new committees, Roxanne is going to lead a committee on Board of Health relations. We've had a lot of conversations about how we can have a better relationship with the Board of Health and how we know them and they know us. And so I'm looking at Councillor Young and hoping he might be able to stick around for a little bit of time on that committee. But Roxanne's going to lead that group on how we want to move forward, what can we do, do we want to do a retreat, what kinds of things are on our minds for doing that. And the third one, Emily is going to lead. And if you remember back a couple of meetings ago, we talked about setting some strategic goals and work plan for FAC for the next year or two or three or four. And we came up with our discussion notes and we did a little jam board where we kind of put what our priorities are. And so Emily's going to lead this particular group in deciding what those are, or how do we decide where do we start? Because there's a laundry list, and we can't do them all in 1 year or even 3 years particularly. So how do we want to address that? Is there a criteria, a set of criteria, two or three criteria that we look at how do you decide which ones we're going to do more immediately and which ones can be set to another time? So Emily is going to lead that group. So I want to invite any and all of you to, you know, chime in, sit in, and kind of see what it's all about. If you have a particular interest in one of these committees, we welcome you to do that. The committees have until 7:30 to meet, and at that time when your committee that you're in is done, you're free to go. So I'm going to adjourn the meeting at the time that we move into our committee work so that our committees can work freely, and then you're free to go. Any questions or comments about what our next steps are? Frank?
Can we, if we're not on a committee, can we just move between the committees? Can we get a feel?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Go shopping?
Yeah. Well, we thought this was a good time for, sometimes we ask you to be part of a committee and you don't know what it's about, or, you know, and this is kind of an opportunity for you to kind of sit in and listen in and see what the work plan is going to be or what this group is tackling. And so, yes, we would welcome you to kind of, what do they call it, speed date? So, any other questions? Mallory, did you have?
You're more than welcome to either meet in this room, or you can also use the library for the different committee meetings, so keep that in mind. If you're going to hop around to different meetings, you may want to check the library. And then if you could please leave your nameplates, I would greatly appreciate it.
You want us to put it back on the table?
Just leave it there.
Okay.
So there's a little corner over there, and there's a foyer in the library, or the library, we can just spread out in here. So Emily, Roxanne, Jeff, and Marla are the leaders of the groups. And do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. We'll see you next month virtually on May 28th.
Budget committee, if we can meet over here.
Board of Health meeting will be over here.
I think that's
the one from the 60s.